Good morning. This is Northern Light for Friday, April 26th. I'm Monica Sandreski.
And I'm Todd Moe.
A Netflix documentary revealed abuse allegations at a former facility for troubled teens in Ogdensburg, and now the community is grappling with the legacy.
Around here, being a small community, you either know the people of the people, the family of the, you know what I mean? So it was a big shock.
There were rumors. It never sounded good. I had a friend who knew some things about it, and everything she said that I heard about it, it ended up being in the documentary.
Plus, we'll sit down for an in-depth conversation with the director of the Netflix documentary, The Program.
And we'll stop by the home of Potsdam Children's author Rebecca Donnelly to talk about creative inspiration.
It's the creative spark. It's the that flash of, oh my gosh, this is something that I have, this is a story I have to tell, or it's something that I have to put into a book.
Donnelly is out with a new graphic novel, and she's joining us for a story hour tomorrow morning at the Messina Public Library. More details coming up on Northern Light. Stick with us.
Broadcast of Northern Light here on North Country Public Radio is supported by Seacom Credit Union, serving the financial needs of people throughout northern New York and northwestern Vermont, in person, online at seacom.org, and on your smartphone. And the Depot Theater in Westport, inviting all to take a journey without leaving the station. Learn more at depottheater.org.
This is Northern Light. I'm Monica Sandreski.
And I'm Todd Moe. Tomorrow in Ogdensburg, a group of former students at the Academy of Ivy Ridge is holding a protest to draw more attention to their claims of abuse. Their demonstration follows the release of a Netflix documentary called The Program last month. It thrust the now-closed boarding school for troubled teens into the national spotlight. It includes detailed testimony of physical, sexual, and mental abuse allegations, often with found documents as evidence. St. Lawrence County's district attorney has received dozens of abuse claims since the program came out. He's launched an investigation. The state-run St. Lawrence Psychiatric Center suspended some staff members who used to work at Ivy Ridge. Facebook groups of former students have been outing former staff members.
In a letter to the Ogdensburg Journal, former administrator Jason Finlinson said the portrayal of Ivy Ridge was inaccurate. He said there may have been a few isolated incidents of staff misconduct, but he said most of the staff were good, caring people who were interested in the well-being and the personal growth of the students, close quote. Coming up, we have an interview with the film's director, a former student, Catherine Kubler. Ivy Ridge was open from 2001 to 2009 and employed dozens of people from the Ogdensburg area. People in Ogdensburg have been reckoning with Ivy Ridge's legacy. Catherine Wheeler spoke with people around the city and has this story.
Renee and Chip Brazy say when they first turned on the Netflix documentary, The Program, their jaws dropped.
For this area, because we are from here, it was kind of like a bomb being dropped off where people didn't really know what was going on.
The Brazies watched all three episodes of The Program. In it, the filmmaker and other former students of the Academy at Ivy Ridge return to the now-closed facility in Ogdensburg. They lay out abuse allegations that took place in the facility between 2001 and 2009. In a letter to the Ogdensburg Journal, Ivy Ridge's former director denied the claims of abuse, saying, quote, "There may have been a few isolated incidents of staff misconduct that we were unaware of, but that was not the norm." Renee Brazy says she had no idea what was allegedly going on inside of Ivy Ridge.
So people watching the documentary that don't live around here, yes, they're probably upset about it, but around here being a small community, you either know the people of the people, the family of the, you know what I mean? So it was a big shock for people living here.
Dorian Lenny Wallace was in high school around the time Ivy Ridge closed in 2009.
There were rumors. It never sounded good. I had a friend who knew some things about it, and she said there was a point system. And everything she said that I heard about it, it ended up being in the documentary.
Lenny Wallace says she doesn't remember how her friend seemed to know about what was going on inside, but she did believe her.
You wish you could have done something about it, but it was shut down pretty soon after I heard those things. So, and, you know, I was a kid.
Renee Brazy says one thing people did know about Ivy Ridge, it was a source of a lot of jobs. At one point, Ivy Ridge had about 250 employees, according to the Watertown Daily Times.
I mean, at the time, that was a place that hired a lot of people. And up here, I mean, that jobs were hard to come by and still are hard to come by. So places like that, that will hire a lot of people, that you look at it like that's a good thing, not expecting something like that to happen.
For decades, Ogdensburg has been a city of corrections and mental health care. There were two state prisons and the St. Lawrence Psychiatric Center. Generations of families have worked in these institutions. Katie Maloney, who grew up in the area, says it makes sense that a boarding school for troubled teens would fit.
I do feel like Ogdensburg positioned themselves throughout their existence from when I came around as, you know, finding good jobs and employment and opportunities for people to stay here and raise their kids and do what they, you know, need to do. And sometimes that did involve helping, you know, working with the mentally ill or incarcerated individuals.
St. Lawrence County legislator and Ogdensburg business owner Jim Reagan says he sees these jobs as a strength. He says the community has a long history of caring for people.
We had two nursing homes to take care of the elderly. We had extensive programs to take care of developmentally disabled, and we welcome them into our communities at times when in many other communities they were seen as unacceptable people. So the notion that people in Ogdensburg, you know, were turning away and looking away and were aware of this kind of behavior, I don't accept that.
Reagan says the allegations about Ivy Ridge don't change the way he sees his community. He says now it's time for the justice system to step in.
When crimes occur, they need to be investigated. They need to be prosecuted. Laws need to be examined to determine whether or not there's a way to ensure that they don't happen again.
St. Lawrence County's district attorney and sheriff's offices say they are investigating the allegations, and officials encourage former students who want to report abuse to contact their offices. Catherine Wheeler, North Country Public Radio in Ogdensburg.
Lucy Grinden also contributed to this story. Coming up after the break, an interview with the director of the Ivy Ridge documentary, The Program.
Listening to Northern Light here on North Country Public Radio. It's 8 minutes past eight. Good morning. I'm Todd Moe.
And I'm Monica Sandreski. Coming up in about 15 minutes, a conversation with children's author Rebecca Donnelly about her new graphic novel, Survival of the Fittest. She's joining us at the Messina Public Library tomorrow morning from 10 to noon for a celebration of children's literature and North Country children's authors. It's coming up in just a few minutes right here on Northern Light.
Guitarist Evan Veenstra out of Gananoque, Ontario. Broadcast to Northern Light is supported by Adirondack Foundation, making grants to nonprofits that address community issues of childcare, attainable housing, career pathways, basic needs, and more. AdirondackFoundation.org. And by NCC Systems, protecting North Country businesses and homes for 50 years, offering cameras, security, fire alarms, and entry control. NCCSystems.com.
In the documentary about Ivy Ridge, the program, more than a dozen students, including the director herself, describe military-like conditions where they were punished for talking, looking at anyone, or looking out the window. It also contains actual video and print evidence of the alleged abuse. That's because the film mayor, Catherine Kubler, found it all at the site of the abandoned school in Ogdensburg. She told David Summerstein she first wanted to make this documentary back when she was a 15-year-old at Ivy Ridge in 2004.
When you're a kid, you're still finding out about the world. I was like, well, no one told me that this could happen to you. Well, jails for children, that you don't even need to commit a crime or get a trial in jail, like in sentencing to like go. You're just thrown in there and you don't know how long you'll be there. I was like, I don't think people know about this. I need to make them aware. So that's when I was like, as soon as I get out of here, I'm going to make a documentary and I'm going to expose all of this.
Did you realize that you could walk right in to the former building? You know, this is the abandoned building of the Academy at Ivy Ridge here in Ogdensburg.
In December of 2019 is when I first found out. What happened is my friend Molly, who is in the documentary with me, reached out to me on Facebook. And she was like, well, I don't know if you've heard, but the building has been abandoned and all of our files are still in it. She's like, I have your file. I can send it to you if you want, or I can burn it. I know a lot of people just want to forget about this part of their life and move on. And I was like, no, send it to me. You know, I've been trying to make a documentary about these places. Like, please send me my file. And I was like, I need to see this for myself. I had spent years pushing, trying to get this made. Now we would finally have the proof. And this was game changing. So my first trip back to the building was in February 2020. And it was so cold. I think I nearly got frostbite. I had to trudge through like 2 feet of snow. But it was the most like surreal experience.
Considering how hard we tried to get out of the building while we were there, it's funny to think we'd be coming back. But we needed to find proof so that people would believe us. Because there are still kids trapped in these places.
That's creepy.
I never imagined they would just leave all the evidence just sitting there.
It's so weird to find this stuff. Why did they keep this shit?
Door to the gym was open, but there was overgrown ivy going in. It was so creepy. And I walked in and the first thing I see is these chairs set up in a circle. Clearly a bunch of Ivy Ridge kids or people had been back through already and, you know, left their marks on the wall or had seen things. But most of it was just like untouched, like a time capsule.
There's a lot of graffiti on the walls. Things like daddy never understood. They abuse kids. It's in the constant background of the documentary as you're making it. Where did that graffiti come from?
Yeah, so on my first trip back to the building, I remember walking into the gym and seeing this graffiti along the wall that said, we will get by, we will survive, WASP survivors, referencing this Grateful Dead song. And I was like, oh my gosh. So not only is it validating to see the building, but to see that other people had been there and left their mark and are telling their story to let people know what had really gone on there.
I wanted to ask, you know, you talk about you can't really show exactly what happened there, but you use reenactments a lot. And I was wondering how you know, some are very sort of elaborately staged. You even dress in the uniforms that you had to wear at one point. But some of it is people telling their stories in the room where they allegedly happen. And, you know, how did you come about, you know, using that as a technique? And did you rehearse those things?
I wouldn't call them reenactments because I actually hate reenactments. There's a lot of documentaries that do a lot of like they get actors and they state because you don't have footage to show what's happening. And I hate reenactments. So I was like, I'm not going to do it. You know, my intention, because it is a, you know, huge thing to ask all these trauma victims to return to the place of the trauma. So I really, you know, we all tried to keep this very dark humor about the whole thing with it. And, you know, it's a way to release tension. Since we don't have footage of what happened, All of a sudden, though, we have this amazing set piece of the entire building. And so that was really great because I didn't want to just, you don't want to sit down a trauma survivor and just be like, tell us everything that happened to you. You know, it's different. But being able to walk through the building, as we're walking through, memories return.
You can see how small these rooms are. They're not very big at all. A lot of times, either I'd be facing a wall and staring at a wall for hours, or they would have me face down. I would have to be on my stomach with my arms out and my feet out, and then with my chin on the floor, so up like this. So I would just have to sit there for hours.
Ended up being a more like healing and taking back the power type process being there. And so there are a few things, and no, none of them were rehearsed at all.
As you probably know, the St. Lawrence County District Attorney are investigating Ivy Ridge now in the wake of your documentary coming out and so many people coming forward with their stories of abuse. What do you want to come out of that? Who do you want?
Some justice.
Who do you want to be held accountable, you know?
First of all the staff that were complicit in this, because, and I will say this, there's been a lot of discussions we're seeing within the Ogdensburg community online of people like, was this person a bad person or were they a good person? And it's like, okay, there were some very bad staff that like literally abused kids. And I could give a whole list of other ones. And I think we're working with the community to leak the names of the ones that we know are the most complicit in the abuse. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you have staff that are weren't necessarily abusing kids and that were actually nice to us. And, you know, that's the least you can ask, is that someone treats a child with humanity and empathy. So there were people like that at Ivy Ridge. And there are staff that have reached out, be like, I'm so sorry. Like, I have no idea. The ones that I can forgive are the ones that saw what was happening and left. Like, I want no part of this. But there are staff that stayed there for several years as family reps. And even though they may not have abused us, how can you see hundreds of children walking around in complete silence, not able to look out the window, not able to like have access to communicate with their family, being restrained, and think that's okay?
The documentary goes even bigger, especially in the third episode, you know, way beyond Ivy Ridge, and is talking about the organization WASP that was, you know, that coordinated all these other, you know, so-called schools as well. And even beyond that, other places around the world, the whole industry of the troubled teen industry. How do you want your documentary to affect that entire world?
My goal was to expose the methodology of how these places work. I don't want people to look at this and be like, oh, Ivy Ridge was this one bad apple and it's shut down now, so what does it even matter? Ivy Ridge is a case study of a much, it's a symptom of a much larger disease. It was a really good case study to have because we had all the evidence in the of all of it. But this stuff is still going on to this day. And it may not be called Ivy Ridge or be under the WASP umbrella anymore, but these programs are still out there and operating. So what I hope people take away from it is the fact that me, for having a Mike's Hard Lemonade, and my friend Nikki, who was a heroin addict, were sent to the same place and given the same treatment is absolutely bonkers. They should know that any place that restricts communication with the family, that's a red flag. So what I want to do is just point out all these red flags of how these places operate, so that when people come across it in its current form, they'll recognize it and stay away or report it or get it shut down. There's not ever going to be a place where you can ship off a child and expect them to get fixed and sent back to you as a perfect child. What they'll come back to is a shell of a human that's been programmed and is a robot, broken down and just with complex PTSD from it all.
Catherine Kubler is a former student of the Academy at Ivy Ridge in Ogdensburg. She directed the documentary The Program, which is on Netflix. She spoke with David Summerstein, the former administrator of Ivy Ridge, Jason Finlinson, described the portrayal of the facility as inaccurate in a letter to the Ogdensburg Journal. Firefighters rescued two kayakers in St. Lawrence County on Wednesday afternoon near Governora. The kayakers had been out on Yellow Lake. One of their kayaks had sunk. They'd ended up on a remote piece of shore not accessible by road. Both had been exposed to the cold water. Three volunteer firefighters and two EMS workers took a boat across the lake to find them. Ambulances then transported them to the hospital. In a post on its Facebook page, the fire department reminded people to wear life jackets and to use extra caution at this time of year, since lakes and rivers are extremely cold and can quickly cause hypothermia symptoms.
The Ronald McDonald House in Syracuse expects to finish its $1.1 million expansion project this spring. Renovations on the fourth floor will add six new residential suites for families with children receiving medical care at local hospitals. The new suites will be able to accommodate larger, multi-generational families and longer stays. They'll also have dedicated remote workspaces for parents who need them. They should be open by sometime this summer. So far, Ronald McDonald House has raised about $800,000 to pay for the project. They're asking community members to help them raise the last $300,000.
When fires happen in people's homes, smoke detectors can save lives. And it's easy to get smoke detectors installed absolutely free. As Lucy Grinden reports, the Red Cross can help.
The North Country's had a lot of fires this year. In January, WWNY-TV reported 8 in St. Lawrence County on a single day.
On average, we get about 10 calls for home fires a day.
Madeline Clark is a disaster program manager for the Eastern New York Red Cross, which includes the North Country.
Fires happen frequently and they happen to everybody. And so it's important just to know to take care of yourself. And, you know, in the unfortunate event that you do have a home fire, make sure that you know how to get out of your home and that your detectors will go off.
Clark says lots of people don't have working smoke detectors in their homes. Often, people remove their smoke detectors themselves.
The battery would go dead, it'd start beeping, and people would take off the smoke detector off the wall and never replace it. And that is a major risk factor when you're talking about getting out of a home fire alive.
But since 2019, the state has required a different kind of detector with built-in batteries that last 10 years. And anyone can get those installed by the Red Cross for free.
We don't ask questions about people's income level, their housing situation. We're pretty neutral. So if somebody requests it, we will install it.
Tomorrow, volunteers with the Red Cross will visit 20 households in Ogdensburg to install free smoke detectors. People can call the Red Cross anytime at 518-694-5121 to ask someone to come to their house. The Red Cross also has special detectors for people who are hearing impaired. Lucy Grinden, North Country Public Radio.
You're listening to Northern Light here on North Country Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Todd Moe.
And I'm Monica Sandreski. Coming up in just a minute, a conversation with Potsdam Children's author Rebecca Donnelly about her new graphic novel, Survival of the Fittest. Then stick around after the show for Bird Note coming up at 8:42. But first, Todd has a look at the weather for us.
Weather Service says sunshine today, highs this afternoon, 50s near 60, light winds out of the south. We'll see some clouds move in tonight, lows around 30, and then what the Weather Service calls isolated showers and thunderstorms starting tomorrow and continuing into the early part of next week with mild temperatures, highs tomorrow, upper 60s, light winds out of the southeast, and then a high upper 60s, low 70s on Sunday, highs again in the 60s and the low 70s the early part of next week. Right now in Canton, sunshine and 37 degrees, and John Warren checks outdoor conditions in the Adirondacks for the weekend.
On Saturday, sunrise in the high peaks will be at about 5:52 and sunset at about 7:55. Aside from a chance of shower Saturday night into Sunday, it looks like a pleasant spring weekend in the Adirondacks, although high peak summit wind chill temperatures will be near freezing on Saturday. Skiing is now over everywhere for the season, and whitewater rafting has begun. Most rivers and streams are a bit below normal levels for this time of year, but that could still mean some higher waters and difficult stream crossings in the high peaks due to snowmelt. The Hudson River is expected to be a bit over 4 feet on the gauge at North Creek. The Racket River will be at about 7.5 feet on the gauge at Piercefield. Over at Lake Champlain, the gauge above Whitehall is at about 98.5 feet. DEC has been installing docks at boat launches around the region and is working on getting the gates opened on seasonal roads. Keep in mind that waters remain very cold, and all people in boats less than 21 feet in length are required by law to wear a life jacket until May 1st. Expect popular hiking trails to be busy this weekend, and parking at some to be at a premium. Expect to encounter muddy areas, and remember to walk through, not around mud, to avoid winding trails. And bear canisters are now required for overnight camping in the Eastern High Peaks Wilderness through November 30th. And finally this week, look for an increase in migrating birds moving through the area. Those are the outdoor conditions in the Adirondacks this weekend. For North Country Public Radio, this is John Warren from the New York Almanac, online at newyorkalmanac.com.
You're listening to Northern Light right here on North Country Public Radio. I'm Monica Sandreski here with Todd Moe. And libraries throughout the region are celebrating National Library Week this month. Tomorrow, Todd and I are joining the folks at the Messina Public Library and hosting a story hour for kids with three North Country children's authors, Jessica Laurel Kane, Maxwell Eaton III, and Rebecca Donnelly. Donnelly writes fiction and nonfiction with several books, including How Slippery is a Banana Peel and How to Stage a Catastrophe. And she's out with a brand new graphic novel this week called Survival of the Fittest. I stopped by her house in Potsdam, and she told me she sharpened her story skills as a children's librarian in New Mexico and here in the North Country in Norwood and Potsdam. And she says it's like seeing literacy in action.
There is nothing like interacting with actual child readers to give you an idea of not just what they're looking for, but how they think about books, how they think about stories. I've done picture books. I've done middle grade. I have done a bunch of beginning readers. I have my first graphic novel is coming out. I have done middle grade nonfiction as well as fiction. So for me, it's actually really about the idea. It's about the spark, what the idea is, and where it's going to fit in the landscape of publishing. Like, what is the best way for me to develop this idea into a book?
When you think about, like, that spark that you're talking about, like the creative spark, you mean?
Mm-hmm. It's the creative spark. It's that flash of, oh my gosh, this is something that this is a story I have to tell, or it's something that I have to put into a book. So the story that I always tell when I speak to groups, is about Cats Are Liquid. That is the fastest I have ever gotten an idea, written it down, sent it to an agent, et cetera, et cetera. And it was listening to North Country Public Radio, believe it or not.
Wow.
It was an NPR story, but it was about the Ig Nobel Prizes, those fake science prizes. So there was one for a paper about proving that cats are liquids because they don't hold their own shape. When you put them into a container, they take up the shape of the container, so they must be liquids. So there's a French physicist who actually did, you know, this math and wrote this paper, and it got the Ig Nobel Prize. And I heard it, and I just said, oh, that is a picture book, and I'm going to write this picture book. And I did. And it took me about 2 weeks. It's not a very long book. So sometimes that is the spark. Sometimes the spark is a little bit more situational, especially if you're writing something longer and maybe you come up with a character or a line. I have a book called The Friendship Lie, and it's middle grade fiction. And the first line is something like, there was garbage in the bathtub again. You know, and that line got into my head and I had to ask myself why. Mm-hmm. And that's where the story comes from.
You touched on it there, but you've got a new book coming out. It's your first graphic novel, right?
Yes, it is. It's called Survival of the Fittest, and it's the first in a series of three. I'm really excited about this. I think number two comes out in about 6 months and probably the third one next year. It is based on another one of my inspirations, I guess. It's about biomimicry, which is using inventions from nature to solve problems in the real world. And a classic way to do this is by looking at animal adaptations. So what this is a game show called Survival of the Fittest. It's a little bit like Shark Tank, but this one has actual sharks in an actual tank. There are three shark judges, and every book has six animal competitors, and they each have to come before the judges and present an invention that they have made based on some adaptation in their own body. But so you have, for example, a humpback whale who has an idea for a wind turbine with tubercles on it, like the tubercles on her fin, which help her go through the water more easily. So it's a more efficient wind turbine. This first one is all engineering topics. The next one is medical technology and then transportation.
Can we take a look at
Absolutely.
It? We got it right here.
Yeah. Absolutely. So, and this is illustrated again by Misa Saburi, whose work I absolutely love. I'm honored that she wanted to do this because this is her first graphic novel as well.
Oh, cool.
One of my favorite details is that there's a hermit crab host. And I don't make a lot of suggestions when I work with an illustrator. That process is actually a little bit less communicative between the two of us than you would think. Mm-hmm. We communicate through editors and art directors. I don't really communicate directly with an illustrator. But I did include a little note in here that said, I would love to see Hermit Crab changing his shell. And she took that and she ran with it. So he's got a pretty standard little shell. And then later on, you see him in a different type of shell. One of my favorites, though, is he is wearing a bowl. He wears like a little Japanese soup bowl. There he is. All the different shark judges.
Oh, I love the hammerhead.
I love hammerhead sharks. Love. Yes. And this is a lantern shark.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. And then there's a tiger shark. And tiger shark just wants to eat everything. That's because that's what they have, like the garbage cans of the ocean.
Man, like, what's that like for you when you, like, unbox your new book for the first time?
Oh, it is amazing because I've seen the sketches come through. Obviously, I know the words that I wrote, but I wrote them a long time ago. I might have forgotten. And I have seen the color art come through. The process of publishing a book means that you look at it over and over and over again. But until you hold it in your hands, it's almost hard to believe that it's real. Because, you know, when I hold this in my hands, it means somebody else will too. It's not just something on my computer screen.
We've got this Children's Story Hour coming up this weekend. When you work in groups with kids like this, what do you hope to get across?
Well, for something like this, for a story time, we're probably going to have a lot of our younger kids there, early elementary, preschool. So a big part of it is just making them happy to be in the library, making them feel comfortable and excited around books. I always have to remind myself that when I'm reading to a group of kids, the laugh, you know, if you get a laugh, that's a very good thing. But even if you don't, even if they're looking at you with a kind of blank expression, what that means is just as good. It means that there's something going on inside their heads. It means that they're thinking about what you're talking about. And that's the other thing that I always try to do with all ages of kids, is to try to get across some kind of idea so that they can go out and be creative in their own way, so that they can have a little bit more knowledge, a little bit more understanding of the world around them. I think that's the best thing that children's books can do.
Potsdam author Rebecca Donnelly, she and fellow North Country children's authors Maxwell Eaton III and Jessica Laurel Kane are offering a story hour tomorrow morning at the Messina Public Library. It's free and runs from 10 to noon tomorrow morning. We can't wait to see you there. That's it for the show. Morning Edition continues now. I'm Monica Sandreski with Todd Moe. Be well.